this morning with this commandment and the topic of abortion, just for one more Sunday. There's a very important passage that's coming up, and it's found in Exodus chapter 21, verses 22 to 25. So if you can turn there, it has very important implications for the topic of abortion. And so rather than return to the topic later on, I thought, you know, I might as well do it now while we're still on it. And so Exodus chapter 21, verses 22 to 25. If men who are fighting hit a pregnant woman and she gives birth prematurely, but there is no serious injury, the offender must be fined whatever the woman's husband demands and the court allows. But if there is serious injury, you are to take life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, and wound for wound, and bruise for bruise. Let's pray together. Father, what a joy it is to be able to call you Father. And those of us who are dads, we need you. We need a Heavenly Father, and we thank you that you've been there for us, that you have provided for us, that you have saved us, that you have cared for us. And I just pray, Lord, that for all the dads here, that we would become more like you in our relationship with our own children. Lord, I know that many dads feel like they have fallen short in all kinds of areas. And just pray that you would encourage them this morning, point them to Christ as the one who forgives all of our trespasses and shortcomings, and encourage us to become the dad that you have created us to be. Lord, as we come to this morning's topic, again, a serious issue, but pray that you will give us wisdom and insight into your word, for I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, so we have a story here that's not directly about abortion, obviously, and by abortion I mean the intentional termination of a human life within the womb. But what we have here is a story about two men who are fighting. Now, we don't know whether this woman that's going to be involved in this, whether she was trying to help her husband and got hit, or she just happened to be an innocent bystander. In any case, the question is, what should happen if there is harm to this pregnant mother? And so the NIV's interpretation, as you could see, is that this woman gives birth prematurely. What if the woman gave birth prematurely? Now, one interpretation here is that what happened here is that the child was actually born alive. So it did not die. No serious harm came to the child or to the mother. And so it sounds like if that was the situation, then it was seen as, you know, there should be a fine that must be paid. Perhaps for the reckless behavior. You know, it's just like a drunk driver, even though they don't hit anybody. Nevertheless, that behavior was reckless, and therefore you're fined. But then it goes on, what if there was a serious injury? And here we assume that perhaps the harm is being done either to the mother or to the child, so that one of them or both of them, they die. Then, if that's the situation, then apparently there's this law that kicks in, and the individual responsible must face the possibility here of even capital punishment. So if this is the correct interpretation, then the child in the womb has just as much value and protection under Jewish law as an adult person. You could see why this is really important, because by implication, if accidental killing of an unborn child is that serious in God's eyes, resulting in capital punishment, then surely intentional killing of an unborn child would be even a worse crime. So that's how many evangelicals do interpret these verses, but unfortunately there is considerable disagreement about the passage. Some suggest, and maybe if you have an older translation, this is what you're going to read, that the harm that was done in the first section, it would say that it wasn't a premature birth, but it was actually a miscarriage. And so some people put that in there. And of course, if it's a miscarriage, then the baby comes out dead. And then the suggestion is that the person responsible only has to pay a fine, which would suggest that if there's a dead baby, then it's not as serious as a dead mother. A fine must be paid, but it's not capital punishment. But the Hebrew word is not miscarriage, but it actually literally means the children came out. And so most of the newer translations will have that, that it's premature or it's a child that just came out. So I would say that given that there's no agreement amongst the Old Testament Bible scholars, it would be unwise really to build all of one's pro-life position on this particular passage. I think it's still important, but that's why I've been trying to show you some other streams of thought within the Bible that that also point to a pro-life position. But at the very least, what this teaches us is that if there's a pregnant woman around, you must take extra precaution, right? Don't we have those signs? Some people put those signs in the back of their cars, baby on board or something like that. And I think it's supposed to tell us, hey, you know, be careful. There's a very fragile human being in this car. And it would be the same idea. Be careful. There's a very fragile human being inside the womb. So a very important passage, but unfortunately there is quite a bit of disagreement on how to take it. What I want to do today is, given that this will be at least the last sermon on abortion for now, is address some of the arguments and the claims that are given in support of abortion. I have not done that in the last 2 weeks. And maybe give some suggestions on how we can respond when we're having a conversation. And again, I just want to remind everybody, these are life and death issues. And remember that God may use you to speak truth into somebody's confusion and help save a life. So it's very important. These topics are very important. Now, you may have heard it said that the fetus is just a clump of cells. And when people say that, how do we respond? I mean, if we're talking just about the human body, then the truth is we're all a clump of cells, every one of us. But just in reading about the development of a child, I was really struck by this. Let me just give you an idea of what's involved here. This happens within the first month, day one, conception. The sperm joins with the ovum to form one unique cell, often referred to as the zygote. And that contains the complex genetic blueprint for every detail of human development. So right at that point, early on, the child's sex, eye color, height, skin tone, all of this is already decided. Right at the very beginning. A genetically new and unique individual human being exists who did not previously exist. And never again will exist. This is unique, a unique human being. Scientists recently discovered, this is fascinating, that when a sperm meets an egg, an explosion of tiny sparks erupts from the egg at the exact moment of conception. Scientists have even captured these astonishing fireworks on film, and the researchers have said to see the zinc radiate out in a burst from each human egg was breathtaking. Human life literally begins in a bright flash of light. Isn't that amazing? Week 3, the heart muscle begins to pulsate. Third week. Second month, the beginning of the brain and brain waves can be detected. Nose, eyes, ears, arms, legs can now be seen. The skeleton begins to develop. Our unique fingertips, the amniotic sac and placenta are in place and provides nourishment to the embryo. Blood flows into the veins separate from the mother's blood supply. All in the second month. Week 6, the extremities can be seen in much more detail, including all 10 fingers. Every organ is present by the second month. Heart is beating sturdily, the liver makes blood cells, the kidneys begin to function, taste buds are forming, and stomach produces digestive juices. Third month, the fetus is able to grasp and can suck his thumb. In addition to being able to sense touch, the fetus can now feel pain, anywhere between 8 and 13 weeks. At week 11 and 12, the baby begins to make all kinds of facial expressions, including smiling, and the fetus begins to sleep and to wake up. Fourth month, week 13, the gender becomes apparent. Week 14, the fetus is growing very rapidly at this point. The mother can now feel energetic movement. Hair is visible on the scalp. By the end of the fourth month, the fetus weighs a half pound or more and is 8 to 10 inches in length. Fifth month, week 18, the ears are now functioning and the baby can hear his or her mother's voice. Week 22, the head of the fetus now accounts for one third for length. And if this baby were to be born prematurely, she has a chance of survival with intensive medical care. So by around week 21, it's now able to survive outside of the womb with help from the medical technology. And the fifth month, that's just halfway to her scheduled birth date. And the development, I'm going to stop here, but the development is just remarkable. You know, once an embryo develops into a fetus develops into a newborn develops into a toddler into a child into an adolescent, and an adolescent into an adult. So one thing that is very clear is that this is not some disorganized cluster of cells. Nevertheless, we hear it commonly said that it is my body and it is my choice. And so how do you respond to that? What can we say? Of course, one thing we can say is that to be perfectly accurate, what we are describing here is really two bodies, right? We can simply ask the question, how many bodies does a human being have? Or rather, how many arms does a human being have? Two arms, two legs, one heart. But if what comes out is your body, right, you would have to say, wow, did you have four legs? Four arms? Obviously, that what is emerging is a different body. If we're talking about a person's appendix or gallbladder, then we say, absolutely, that is your body. But we have two bodies here. It's very clear. Some might go on to say, nevertheless, it's still my body, and I should be allowed to do with my body what I want. And here, I think we can respond by quoting the old saying, your right to swing your fist ends where my nose begins. Absolutely, we want people to have choice, and in some ways, the more choice, the better. But we don't want people to have choice to harm others, to harm other human beings using their bodies to do so, especially if these other human beings are innocent. So we don't have any God-given right. We don't have any moral right to actually harm another human being. I grant that the laws of this land do permit you to harm another person, but those laws are unjust. Those laws are immoral. And I would prefer to hear and to vote for laws across the board that would protect the most vulnerable from bullies, to protect the oppressed from oppressors, to protect and to stop the strong who are using violence to destroy the weak, right? So that's one way for us to respond. We do accept that everybody should have choice, but never choice to harm another human being. Now, thirdly, some say it's their body and that nevertheless, they have no moral responsibility to use their body to save the life of another person. I don't know exactly what the laws are on this, but if you were to see, let's say, a child drowning in a pool, and you're the only one around, okay? You're the only one who could save that child, and your answer is, well, it's my body, and I can do with it as I want, and I don't have to save another life. I don't know about the legal application of that, but it's definitely not very neighborly. Not very kind, not very loving, to know that you could have saved a life, but you chose not to. But in this case, when we're talking about abortion issues, we're not talking about some child in a pool or some stranger. If you're pregnant, then you're a biological mother of the child. You have a unique relationship. And it's a relationship of dependency where the weak needs the strong in order to live. In the same way, when the child is in your womb, I believe that it is morally required that the mother does everything she can to provide the necessities for life. For her child, until that child can survive on their own. And the same applies when the child is delivered. There is a responsibility of the mother to take care, or the parents to take care of that child. You have to use who you are, including your body, to take care of that human being. And so what is true outside of the womb is also true inside the womb. Now, some of you might be, you know, thinking, of course, what people are saying, and this is the million-dollar question, but when does a human life begin? Right? That's the most important question. And Christians traditionally have always argued that life begins at conception, and that particular life at conception is a human life. What other kind of life could we say it is if it's not human? I mean, since the beginning of history, has a woman ever given birth to a dog or to a cat or animal life or plant life or alien life? Obviously, that life inside is human life. And we don't need the Bible to tell us that human beings produce human beings. And I would suggest that if it is life, and that life is a human life, that human lives, and I'm making a moral statement here, human lives have intrinsic value, an inherent value. That's why in the language of the American Constitution, it says it has inalienable rights. Human beings have inalienable rights, and these rights do not come from the government. They're not given by the parents, but from the Creator. So I think this is very important. What do you do if somebody comes along and says, you have no value? Do you depend on, like, is your value dependent on what the government has to say about you? Even if your parents say that you have no value, they're wrong. God has given us value. I like what John Perkins says. We don't have to give anyone dignity. They already have it by the mere fact that they are created in God's image. So if it is a human being, then it should qualify as a human person. And if it's a human person, then it has inherent human rights, and the laws of the land should protect and defend these human rights. It's the right to life. It's a human right. Now, this is a very contentious point, and many reject the view that life begins at conception, or they say that the human being or human person does not begin at conception, even though their life may, some kind of biological life. And so what happens next? Well, then, if it doesn't begin there, then you have to start asking the question, where does it begin? When do we start protecting that life, right? When does it become human? When does it become a person? So if it doesn't start at the beginning, then we have to try to figure out when it does. And so all kinds of, you know, philosophers and lawyers and others begin to try to come up with some starting point. When does it happen? Well, here's some criteria that you'll discover, all right? Some people say, well, it requires a certain physical criteria. All the organs must be present in rudimentary form. When there is blood circulation, when there's a heartbeat, when there are brain waves, okay? And by the way, these keep changing as well, but what about social criteria? There are some who think, no, there has to be some social criteria. Physical criteria, that's not a human being. You know, a human being is much more than just what they are in terms of their body. Social criteria. There must be human interaction. There must be communication. Intellectual development. Acquisition of language. Communication. Oh, sorry. Anyways, they go on in this vein that you need these things in order to be called a human person. Others say, no, it's mental criteria. There has to be self-consciousness or self-awareness. There has to be reason. There has to be volition. It has to be able to judge between right and wrong. Curiosity, affection, self-control, memory. I mean, here's one bioethicist, Joseph Fletcher. Humans without some minimum of intelligence or mental capacity are not persons, no matter how many of these organs are active. So, as you can see, they're all disagreeing about what is it that makes a human being, and when does it begin? There's no agreement. And if you pay attention to the criteria, you can see why many bioethicists are actually going to support infanticide, right? Being able to tell between right and wrong, communication. I think Dr. William Lilly states it correctly. He says, there has grown up the habit of regarding the fetus as the neonate as a poorly functioning adult rather than a splendidly functioning baby, right? If you listen to the criteria, these are criteria for older human beings. Now, some say that it's at the moment of viability. That's when it can survive outside of the womb, and they no longer need to depend on their mothers anymore. which prompted one person to say, most high school students are unable to survive without their mothers. Viability, I mean, also keeps changing with the progress of science and technology. I've heard it as early as 20 weeks. Most people seem to say even up to 21 weeks it can now survive outside of the womb. But again, I just emphasize that, you know, you ask the question, you know, who do you listen to amongst these bioethicists? There's disagreement all over the place. In Canada, when do you get treated as a human being? You're only treated as a human being when you emerge out of the womb. You have no status, legal status, in the womb as a human being. It's only when you come out. So just think of it, you know, you come out, you're a human being. 2 minutes before, you weren't. In the United States, most ethicists don't deny. They do not deny that the fetus is human, that it's a human being. You know what they say is that the fetus is not a human person. It is a human being, but it's not a human person. So let that sink in, all right? You can be a human being, but you're not a human person. All right, so all persons are human, but all humans are not persons. You know, you thought that all human beings are supposed to be born equal, but apparently some are more equal than others. So from a Christian point of view, the best approach is just to utterly reject these distinctions. And we say, if you're human, if you belong to the human family, then you are a human person. And thus, we believe that every child should be protected by law. If you're human, you're a human being, and you're a human person. And we don't have to talk about what's happening inside your brain and all the rest of the stuff. It's enough for us to see that you have a human body. We can leave out the question about when does the soul enter the body and all the rest. Friends, it's so dangerous. Do you just pick up on how dangerous it is for human beings, adult human beings, to say to other human beings, you're not a human being? That is so dangerous. But it has happened many times. You probably realize that slaves were not called humans, and because they were not humans, they were not recognized by the state, having any legal rights. They were also seen as biologically inferior to their owners. They were considered his property. And I've heard in various arguments where pro-choice folk have said that the fetus is the property of the woman. And then later, you know, there's all these other arguments. Releasing the slaves will have a negative impact on the U.S. economy. Freeing slaves would result in widespread unemployment. And on, there's always these other economic issues and everything else. And moving further and further and further away from the issue is, yeah, but wait a minute. Is that person a human being or not? Is it a human person that deserves to be protected? There was a medallion of a slave on his knees. I don't know if you've ever seen this. He's in chains and then with his arms out and makes the statement, am I not a man and a brother? So what is really the difference between the baby in the womb and an adult outside of the womb. There's a ethicist by the name of Scott Klusendorf, who came up with an acronym called SLED. And he said, I'll tell you what the difference is. One of the differences is size. You who are outside of the womb are much bigger than the fetus who is still very small. But do you want to deny a person's humanity because they're smaller on the basis of size? Should the bigger and the stronger have more rights than the smaller and the weaker as a principle? John Wilkie, we did not come from a single cell. Rather, each of us was a single cell, and all we have done since then has been to grow up. That's how we started. That was the beginning of your life, really tiny. Secondly, so the first is size, SLED. Secondly, is the level of development. You know, as you move along or as an adult, we're more developed than the fetus, than the child, than the teenager, so on and so forth. We've had more time to develop. But if the fetus is given the opportunity, it'll develop just like everybody else. The terms embryo and fetus do not refer to non-humans, but to human beings that have not yet reached a particular stage of development. I think it's a really important distinction that a fetus is a person with potential, not a potential person. You see the difference between that? Really important distinction for us. Thirdly, SLE, the environment is different. We're out here and the fetus is in there. It's a question of location, it's a question of geography. And a human being's rights should not be determined on whether it's out here versus in there. The location should not have the final say. And then fourthly, the dependency. A fetus, a child within the womb is more dependent than it is now. Again, it's so dangerous to start talking about, well, because of dependency. I mean, you know, that's what makes the whole difference. I mean, a fetus, yes, is very dependent, but so are elderly people. So are disabled people. So are people in comas. They're very dependent. Are we going to conclude that you're not human because you're dependent? Are we going to take away their rights because they're too dependent? So here it is. I think that the pro-life position, the biblical position, is an inclusive view, really. It says no human being, regardless of its size, skin color, level of development, race, gender, or place of residence, should be excluded from the community of human persons. Right? This view is very inclusive. It's wide open to everybody, to the small, to the vulnerable, to the weak, to the defenseless. That's what we hold. Now, in response, some do say, look, there's just so much controversy of that. Nobody really knows when a fetus becomes a human being or a person, so I'm just going to be of the mindset that let each person decide for themselves. But why not instead say, if we're not sure when life begins, then we should choose in favor of life. You should always give life the benefit of the doubt. Just think of it. What if later on you have to, you mean we've been killing human beings this whole time? Again, some have said that bringing unwanted children into the world will only increase child abuse. And I think the answer to that is that abortion is the ultimate act of child abuse. It's violent, extremely violent. In many cases. So because, by the way, sometimes Christians just also have this idea that, you know, well, I myself would never have an abortion, but I'm not going to tell anybody else not to. That's up to each individual. And I wonder if we would say the same thing about other commandments, I don't know, like stealing. I personally would never steal, but I'm not going to tell anybody else whether they should or not. Like this is worth, if this commandment applies, which I'm saying it does, then it's murder. It's even more serious than stealing. I do believe that our government is failing to live up to one of the most basic responsibilities, Romans 13, that God gives to government officials, and that is to protect innocent life. And as Canadians, we should be very concerned with the ongoing practice of killing 100,000 children, babies every year, and in the States, it's a million. It's just it's a human slaughter. And I guess that many are asking this question, one that we do not often ask: Is God just gonna, like, he doesn't care? He's gonna turn a blind eye to all of this, or is this going to lead to the judgment of God upon a nation? Because to kill an image bearer is to attack God in whose image that person is. Last comment. I had a conversation with a neighbor of mine not very long ago, and he was very strong, wanting to defend women's rights and the pro-choice position. And I wasn't getting very, very far with him either. But I said to him, you know, here's the irony of this discussion that we're having. So if your mother was standing right here, right now, and she was pregnant with you, and there were two of us, and she wasn't sure what to do, and there was two of us, myself and somebody who holds views very similar to you. So I'm standing there and I'm telling your mother, you know, it has inherent value. Let him live. Give him a chance. A human being. Don't do this. And then you have somebody else that says, oh, it's just a blob of cells, tissue in your body. No big deal. Completely up to you. You don't have to think about that individual or anything. I said, the ironic issue is that, you know, if she chooses to have you, then you come out, and then when you grow up a little bit, you think that guy over there is your friend and I'm your enemy. We in the pro-life position are your friend. We are the ones who are arguing and trying to defend every life in the womb, whether they turn out to be pro-choice or whether they turn out to be pro-life. But we are arguing for individuals to have a chance at life, that they are valuable.